I'm Tom Cocaine. Have you ever wanted to meet someone that you're a fan of and just sit down and have a talk?
Well, that's what I got to do earlier this year.
To who I think is one of the greatest comedic minds of our age, Eric Idle. If you don't know him by name, he's one of the famous British comedy group, Monty Python's Flying Circus. But that's only a portion of his life and talent. He's a writer, a singer-songwriter, and actor, and he's a voracious reader. Did you know, though, that he lives in Los Angeles? He's had a house there since the mid-90s, and that's where he keeps active by writing, playing music, and at 70 years old, this is where he likes to obsess about things that keep his mind busy. His daughter keeps him busy, too. She recently graduated from Whitman College in Walla Walla, where Idle gave the commencement address in May of 2013. In that address, he talked a lot about, and had a continuing joke, on irony. You said that irony is dead. When George Bush gets a library, irony
yes.
is dead. Now, did you mean that, or is that just a way of keeping that joke going about irony?
Well, no, it's me who's labeled it the post-ironic age. And I think that, you know, once you've got the Kardashians on television and all those reality things, once Snooki, there's no irony left. I mean, nobody's embarrassed or ashamed about anything. It's like, it's just possible to pitch any reality show, isn't it?
It seems like it.
That, you know, Bigfoot, search for Sasquatch, you know, I mean, there's unbelievable amounts of shows going on. You think, who actually watches this without understanding it's hilarious?
That's almost something that, with you and the Pythons, did.
Well, you can't make up things now beyond what people are doing, if you see what I mean. It's like, it's already too far. You can't mock things. They've gone too far.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's beyond irony, isn't it? I was thinking about post-irony because I've been writing a novel and it's called a post-ironic novel, which I quite like. You know, that's the basic gist of it, really. I mean, Fox News is beyond irony. It's ridiculous.
So what is irony then?
Anymore? Well, irony is a secondary meaning. People seeing a secondary meaning in something or realizing it's amusing. So I was having difficulty defining post-ironic, actually, because that's not so easy. It's like when there is no secondary meaning and nobody's even noticing it could possibly be remotely funny. So it's like people admiring the costumes on the Emperor's New Clothes, which will probably be a TV show soon.
A reality show.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It'll be like Joan Rivers, you know. What are you not wearing?
Well, that's good. That, you know, the thing is that could really fly.
Well, we love Joan. I love Joan Rivers. I think she's the funniest person in America, almost. She's so great. She has no motor control over her mouth. It's fabulous. That's a sign of a great comedian. They have no censoring mechanism whatsoever.
Being a great comic himself, he would certainly know a good one when he sees one. But he uses much of his comedic skill in writing songs. He wrote a song about the galaxy, including its known size at the time, speed at which it travels, the number of stars. But as scientists learn more about space, these things change. But when he works on changes or anything else, it's because it's what he wants to do.
I don't look for work. I don't accept work. You know what I mean? I don't have agents and things. I go away, leave me alone. But I do carry on writing and thinking up things. I'm afraid I can't stop that.
So this is what you do now, is you basically do what you want and write?
Exactly so. And then now and again I'll do a performance like the Olympics, or I'm going to do Jack Black's festival in October. You know, I have little gigs, things that I can turn out and do things. And then I go, why the heck did I do that? But... you know, I think that sort of it keeps you alive, and it's important. You know, I don't want to do other people's things.
In what terms?
Well, movies or television or comedy. You know, I'm not interested. I've got to a certain age where I'm going, wait a minute, this is my life. I've only had a little time of it left. I'm really going to sort of do what I want to do and work on things like I just had Professor Brian Cox come here, and it was very interesting. You know, we were thinking of ideas and things to do. But that's more in the real world, you know, in intelligent thought.
And you've also got the song about the universe.
But right.
What is it that you're doing with Brian Cox now?
Well, I did a remake of that song for him last year for his TV program Wonders of Life. And I rewrote all the lyrics and we re-recorded it. And it's a different, separate version 30 years later, but it's more about the evolution of biological life on this planet and the dates of that, and the current width of the universe. Every time he comes to see me, he always tells me the bad news is we've got to think it's a little bit bigger now. And so it's really hard to write lyrics for these people. They keep changing their mind.
Something that hasn't changed in Eric Idle's mind is when he does work on rewriting or whatever he chooses to do, he does so mainly during certain parts of the year. He has set up his work life to go in cycles, similar to going to school. While he chooses to spend his summers in southern France, his school year, if you will, is spent working on things in his Los Angeles home. So is this how your work life is?
It is like what my work life is. And then I'll get to France, and usually after I've been there a few weeks, I'll start thinking of an idea or writing something. It's a good place to write and think and paint or do anything, doodle. And then when I come back, you know, it's the fall, and you go, well, yes, here we are now, a new term. What are we going to do? So, yes, I do very much take the academic year, I'm afraid. I never got it out of my system.
That sounds like a good way to go about it, really.
I think it's an essential way to go about it. Because I find when I'm here and it's springtime, I get new ideas, I write, and things are growing. And then by the time you get into long summer, you just want to relax with a book or swim or, you know what I mean? I think you have to go fallow in order to go forward. I think you have to put away things that you were working on or forget about them. And then you can pick them up again and they, you go, oh, of course, oh dear, oh, that works, that doesn't work. You know, so that's my process anyway with stuff. I turn it over. After about 6 to 8 months, I'll go back and read it. You know what I mean? I let things sit.
And that's pretty much what you've done with some recent projects, like Spamalot, but then like also your thing, What About Dick? Weren't these things that you kind of sat around and then picked up again?
Absolutely. They are. I mean, sometimes they started life as a movie, which What About Dick did. Way, way back. And then I suddenly got an idea for it about 4 or 5 years ago, and that it could be done as a radio performance, you know what I mean, and got people in to read it. And then I could see how funny it was. Because until you put it in front of an audience, it's just a theory. So I did it with, you know, Tim Curry and Eddie Izzard. We did it at the Montalbán Theatre here first. And, you know, it was gangbusters. We did about 3 performances, and the audience just said, yes, thank you. So I then, you know, went away, rewrote it. A couple of years later, we put it on again, you know, and added Russell Brand, which was great. And, you know, I got time to straighten out the plot and think about things more from the terms of what we were trying to do.
Yeah, and it's really great. You play the narrator, which is a piano.
Makes me giggle, though.
yes. Just a thought.
Yeah.
This is what I love about radio, and it seems like you do, too, is that you don't have to show you being a piano.
Right.
It's the theater of the mind.
Yeah, no, of course. And that was the Goons for us. The Goon Show would always, you know, they would set the Thames on fire. So you get an image in your brain, but which you could never film, or you couldn't really. So there's a lot of that absurdity and the use of crossover of language into imagery, which is in Python, I think, because it's still kind of literate. And that's, in a way, because we were all brought up before television. We didn't get television until I was like 11, maybe 12. You know, 13 even. So we grew up on radio. And that is very good for the mind. And it's very close to reading as well. There's something that happens with words that paint images in your mind, which is a kind of not easy to understand how that works, but does brilliantly.
It's those word paintings that are the thrust of Idle's career. There seems to be a line in your career that involves language and lyrics.
Yes.
Why is that so important in your life?
Well, I'd go back to the idea that one's first entertainment form was radio, and then even before records, because, you know, again, before one was quite a certain age, there wasn't rock and roll, you know, so that the radio brought you in rock and roll too with Radio Luxembourg. So the two loves of mine are sort of his music and the popular song and the lyrics. But I always loved good lyric writers like Noel Coward. I just adore, you know, you just can't beat Mad Dogs and Englishmen or, you know, Stately Homes of England. It's the tightest, beautiful, you know, brilliant set of lyrics. So that always pleased me very much. And I guess I was very linguistically I think that one of the things, if you're at a boarding school, that reading is a great escape. And that's what I think I escaped into, is reading. And that sort of is playing patterns on your brain of language. I mean, it's soaking you in language.
A lot of your things that you've done, characters and things, or sketches that you are in, involve language, but a lot of language, where you have these long, like, paragraphs worth of dialogue in the Ruddle's Weekend Television, where you start off and you're talking just words.
Gibberish.
Yeah. How do you do that? How do you memorize it?
Not hard to memorize, but, you know, it's kind of a, I don't know, it's like the funny ideas. Where do the funny ideas come from? I mean, that's what you do. You don't say, where are they coming from? You sit down every morning and try and catch them, you know. I guess I've just been trained to think in the funny terms. So ever since the Footlights in Cambridge, you know, I've been doing writing and performing comedy almost without any other activity. Occasionally there's the odd movies and things, but, you know, what really pleases me is writing and performing and making people laugh, because you just take it in front of people and go, well, here we go, let's hope this works. And people never kind of sympathize. They go, I'd be in agony here before I went up to Waller. No, you'll be funny, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But it's precisely because I worry about it that I will be funny.
So you must get quite a bit of pleasure from taking these ideas that you sit down and write about and then seeing them performed.
Yeah, I think so. I think that is fun. I mean, I just, it's sort of an interesting thing to do anyway, to make up stuff, you know, because where did that come from? Or, you know, or, and then sorting out what's a good idea, what's a bad idea, what needs doing, what will never work. And there's some things that will never work. That's why I put things away and I pick them up and look at them later.
Is there a certain process that you do to come up with these creative ideas?
I go in very early. I wake up and almost go straight to my chair and pick up a pencil and start thinking of ideas, or pick up something that I've already started. That's it. It's like fishing. You have to be by the riverbank to catch fish. You know, if you're not there, you won't get them. It's nice when you get into a rhythm of something, or you're writing something and you just leave a little thread at the end of each day and you pick that up next day and on you go. It's like knitting. Pick up the thread and continue, you know.
Next thing you know, you've got a scarf.
Well, yeah, well, that's true, you know.
Do you type on a typewriter?
No, I do pencil, always pencil. On rule lines or blank paper first. Pencil first, and then I will, if I think it's any good, I'll type it up onto a laptop. But I rewrite. I mean, that's the only secret of writing, is not to be satisfied and just to keep rewriting it. And it can drive you crazy, but it's sort of, if you want to rewrite it, then it needs rewriting. You know what I mean? You can't take any shortcuts with it. Say, oh, this will do, because it won't, ever. Can't even get past your desk, then it shouldn't.
Won't make the light of day.
No, at all. I mean, and there's nothing to say that it should make the light of day, but you just don't know. You might be thinking of something that's going to go on for a long, long time, like Spamalot, or it might be something that is never going to go anywhere.
Something that has gone everywhere is Eric Idle's sense of comedy. Considering all that he knows about comedy, including writing and acting, he seemed like the right person to ask a very difficult question about his profession. So we keep talking about comedy and language and everything. So what then is comedy?
Well, you know, I wrote a book, The Road to Mars, trying to deal with those sort of subjects where a robot worked for two comedians and he was trying to understand what they did for a living, because he couldn't understand comedy and he didn't have any irony either. Because he's a machine, you know. It's like your Mac. Does it have irony? No. I went through it in many different ways. And the one thing that it seemed to me resonated was I was talking about this to Brian Cox the other day too, because it's interesting. It's like, where does consciousness come from? Where does it evolve? And when does it become noticeably consciousness, as opposed to animal consciousness, or which is high consciousness and knowledge of itself, and something to do with being able to laugh at yourself, or being aware that the situation, though terrifying, is funny at the same time, is something that evolves in us, partly possibly through hunting. And that's why I would explain it's more male than for males to get hold of around the females. You know, so it would be, I would think it's something to do with the tribal fears and tribal hunting fears.
And laughing and smiling.
Aggressive signals of the ape, chattering teeth and showing teeth is completely aggressive. And the laugh is extraordinary. It's a bark. This is what was fun writing a book from a robot's point of view, because he couldn't understand why the audience kept barking. Which is exactly what it's like, isn't it? You don't decide to laugh, though. You find yourself laughing. That's the other thing. And it's done en masse. It's done in a pack. It's done in an audience. We've become more sophisticated now. We can laugh on our own watching YouTube but on TV. We've learned to do that, but actually it's essentially a pack activity.
You know, that's interesting because I've seen comedians watch stuff on YouTube or whatever, and I don't laugh. I'm just watching it. I'm just passive. But then I go to see them live, and I'm laughing at everything they say.
Well, yes, that's their skill because it's something going around in the audience. It's like they're spinning this hysteria, and they're surfing off it, and they're riding it, and the skill. I would watch Robin Williams, and eventually he would not be saying anything at all remotely funny, but he'd have the audience just out of their seats with laughter, because it's about timing and flipping and a conspiracy to create this thing, you know. And it's fascinating.
Monty Python did a lot with absurdity, and even with like a Spamalot and things, some things are really absurd. So is that part of what comedy is about, is the absurdity of it?
Well, there's the nonsense. Like, some things have sense and some things have nonsense. And like, you know, Lewis Carroll, they found the nonsense, which is not no sense. It's just the opposite of sense. And in a sense, it was interesting that Lewis Carroll, Charles Dyson, was a mathematician, because that's exactly what mathematics has now led us all into, which is this final absurdity where nothing is where it's supposed to be. You can't tell. It's all uncertainty. It might be, you may be able to tell the speed of it, but you can't tell the place of it. Do you know what I mean? Well, we're constructed of this. It's the alternative truth. It isn't true, but you're saying something which is nonsense and behaving as though it was sense. And that's kind of funny for us because we're comparing our own behavior with what's being parodied here. If we're watching like the Python marathon for incontinence, and they keep changing the lead because they're all going off for a pee into the woods, it's not that silly. From a marathon race, except we've just put a little bit of absurdity into it, so we can perceive of the activity of the marathon race, and then the activity of a marathon race run by people who have weak bladders. That is a nonsense approach, but it's based on something. People actually do this. You know, that it's one of my favorite things of Python. It's the silly Olympics.
Comedy sketches like that are what Monty Python did best, and they would do many in a short 30-minute TV show. But for the most part, Idle has gone away from that type of writing.
Sketch is a young man's thing. That's what we did. We perfected the short sketch, you know. I mean, when you get older, and after your 30s, that's why we moved into movies. They were able to tell larger stories or put characters in. And then when you finally leave that sort of world, I don't write, very rarely write 3-minute sketches. If I have a thing, I might do a blog on it, which is a nice length, or a one-liner for Twitter. But I don't, you know, I don't set off to write sketches. I haven't done for, you know, decades. I would try and write a larger form. And then if you get an idea, you have to decide what its best format for it is. So it might be a good musical idea. It might be a rotten musical idea. It might be a good novel idea. It might be a good TV idea. How that idea is best presented is also part of the skill, whether you can make a novel of it or not.
Just have the idea, work with it, and see
what's forming, what's emerging, and then what's possible if you got it to its best possible state. How would it be like if it began to work? And the work tells you things. I mean, I was working on Spamalot. I did 17 drafts. But not until rehearsal stage did I realize that King Arthur had to end up with the Lady of the Lake and not Galahad. Because in the film, Galahad's the bit of the lad, you know. on the stage, I went, well, wait a minute. You know, she's got to end up with him because he's the king. And so things reveal themselves to you that were always there. Like right at the end, he says, do you have a name? And she says, everyone has a name, Arthur. He says, what's your name? She says, my name is Guinevere. And the knight goes, holy shit. It was like that because only right at the end did I realize that her name could easily be Guinevere, because she's a magic person, Lady of the Lake. So that was always there, but I never noticed it.
This is what's great about theater and writing, is that you can do anything you want because you wrote it. You can suddenly say, oh, well, she's Guinevere. It doesn't have to follow a certain story.
There was a sort of moment when the audience go, of course she is. You are making it up, but also you're presenting solutions to them of what are we dealing with here? Oh, an expectation. So there's that to it as well. It isn't just what you make. I mean, Mike Nichols is very good at this. You know, you have to finish the story, you have to preach the moral, he always said. And there's a moment in Spamalot where the king preaches the moral. The Holy Grail will always be there for those whose hearts and minds look for it. He is very good on structure and audience, how to take them on this story. What is the story? What's the story? What are we saying here? So, you know, whereas Python is not good at story at all, because it's coming from six different minds trying to create all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It didn't really have much narrative. Mm-hmm. And the Grail doesn't have a lot of narrative at all. I had to put a plot into Spamalot. You know, I had to create a plot, make all the characters, shrink them all down to a few that we could take the journey with. There's 98 characters in the Holy Grail. Some of them just come and get killed and walk off. They rarely recur. You know? So it was like trying to make the representative. So I realized that I could make all Michael's characters one, and all my characters one, and collapse them, conflate them, and all John Cleese's. And so you do have a bit of fore and after story for each of the protagonists going through it. It's fun. I like adapting, because adapting, you're not trying to say, what the heck is this story? If you're creating story as well, that's hard. What is the plot? But they're all absolutely vital to the musical. The book is everything. People just think, oh, we've got a lot of songs, we're going to make a musical. Well, actually, no, you're not. It's a fictional form. It's telling you a story. And if it doesn't tell you a story, you're bored within minutes. It's amazing.
Even though everybody's singing and dancing.
You know, that's distracting for a while, but you can't sit for that for 50 minutes and not go, well, I think I've seen a bit of this. You need to want to go into Act Two. What's going to happen now? Those narrative things are vital.
You've done so many characters. It's got to be in the hundreds. Is there a favorite one that you have?
I'm not sure, because it's not like I visit them. They're parts of one's past. I mean, it's always easy to fall back into a sort of Mockney voice, you know. Oh, hello, yeah, fine, charming, isn't it? Yeah, because that's a nice, it's a nice way to comment on things. And if I go into a room and there's a little bit of stiffness, you know, from people are nervous, so you can expect, it's very easy to slip into that sort of a voice. I did it with the orchestra in Walla Walla, because there's 160 people waiting, you know, and they're all ready to drop the baton, and I didn't realize, and I walked right in, and I sort of started to go, oh, bloody hell, look at all this lot then. So it's a way of, you know, taking the tension off the moment, is to slip into a character voice. That's what Michael Palin and I would always do, those sort of voices together.
Take the voices that you do. You've got your regular speaking voice, and then you do a lot of presenters. They have a certain cadence.
Sure, but that has a certain cadence. The BBC, I mean, the Flying Circus is really about television. All those characters are sort of off the television, really, in some documentary form or another. You know, they're...
A documentary never came to mind. But
well, no, I mean, there's many documentary bits in Python, you know, little false documentary stories,
oh, yes.
You know. Essentially, it was about television show, you know, as a television thing. Often being interviewed and saying, well, I think, you know, and then we've got used to that, the talking head saying things. That's one of the television's staples. So we're used to that, if somebody cutting to somebody saying something absurd.
That's pretty much what I have to talk about. Is there anything
sure.
you'd like to add?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
I'm good. Thank you.